This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham from Michigan Radio. A former legislator says there's more to being a lawmaker than making laws.
Assisting constituents, listening to your business community and other groups that you represent is all a key part of the job that we do.
And she says that's more than a part-time job. The Genesee County Treasurer says she won't pursue foreclosure because of liens for unpaid water bills in Flint.
We believe by law that we didn't have to take it because it was an extraordinary event.
And today, an extended segment on the tax foreclosure crisis in Detroit.
The burden of these unconstitutional assessments are really being borne by the homeowners with the lowest valued homes, who are ostensibly the poorest of the poor homeowners.
Plus, a German-born Michigan grandmother's cherry-infused vodka is hitting Michigan store shelves. We'll talk with Oma Steinbart. But first, let's see if anything interesting's happening in the news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Joining me, as they do on most Fridays, are Vicki Barnett, a former mayor of Farmington Hills and a former Democratic legislator, and Ken Sikkema, senior policy fellow with Public Sector Consultants and a former Republican majority leader in the state Senate. So we got a few things to talk about this week. Let's get right to it. First, President Trump's Advisory Commission on Voter Integrity has asked states for all kinds of voter information, including age, party affiliation, partial Social Security numbers, and so on. So most states have refused to give up some of that information. In Michigan, Secretary of State Ruth Johnson makes the call. Vicki, what's been her response?
Well, her response was to not give up the Social Security numbers and the date of birth. She will include the year. I still have a problem with the whole Voter Election Integrity Commission. I don't know what they're going to do with that data. I don't know what program they're going to run it through to try to prove that there's fraud or not prove that there's fraud. So I'm quite concerned with what's going to happen to the data. I find the request from the commission a true invasion of every voting American's privacy rights, and it disturbs me greatly that they had the audacity to actually ask secretaries of state to turn over that kind of detailed information.
Ken, despite President Trump's claims of massive voter fraud, we're told there's almost no evidence to support those claims. So what do you think the reason we're having this advisory commission is?
Well, I think President Trump is trying to pursue claims and accusations he made during the campaign. Now, in terms of the requests made to Michigan, you know, Michigan voter lists are public under state law today. And the Secretary of State, Ruth Johnson, she provides those lists to anybody who requests them. And I think she ought to comply in the same sense. If it's public information and she provides it to other people and entities that request those lists, I think she ought to be able to comply with any request from the Presidential Advisory Commission.
And to be clear, that's not what she's doing. She's only giving the public information that's available to anyone who wants to pay, what is it, $23 for that information or something like that.
Well, and I think that's legitimate, and she ought to comply with that, but no further.
Let's go to the next topic. Lieutenant Governor Brian Kelly started a petition drive to put the idea of a part-time legislature up for a vote of the people. Then he stopped the effort, scrapped thousands of signatures, as Jonathan Oisting with the Detroit News reported. Now he's restarting the effort, but leaving some of his supporters a little ticked off. Vicki, what's Kelly doing here?
I have no idea what he's doing. First of all, to go to a part-time legislature and further eviscerate the powers of the Michigan State Legislature by not even talking about term limits, leaving truly a part-time green legislature that doesn't understand the complexities of what goes on a day-to-day basis is a real problem. And I think that's why so many groups, including the Michigan Chamber of Commerce, have jumped down Lieutenant Governor Kelly's throat on this whole petition drive. He started it. He stopped it. It would really put in jeopardy some of the provisions that allow the legislature to override a veto should they no longer be in session when the governor vetoes a bill. So it's highly problematic. And I also want to point out to your listeners, I served in the legislature, and so did Ken. And we are not just lawmakers. A true representative of the people works very, very long hours, very hard, and lawmaking is only part of their job, assisting constituents, listening to your business community and other groups that you represent is all a key part of the job that we do. And that doesn't end after 90 days, and it doesn't end Monday through Friday. It keeps going on. And it's a job that those of us take seriously really love to serve, and we don't just pass laws.
Ken, I want you to explain what was the reasoning that Lieutenant Governor Kelly pulled the petition and restarted. But at the same time, I also want to talk about the fact that he angered a lot of conservatives. He made a blunder here, apparently. Some of these people are supposed to be his base. Could this have not only hurt his chances for his petition, but his yet-to-be-announced run for governor?
Well, the first attempt that he made was bungled in the sense that the language he wanted to put in the Constitution was pretty flawed, and he realized it. And so that's why he's starting over with some new language to ensure that it can survive any constitutional challenge. But the fact of the matter is the first attempt was bungled. He's doing this clearly, I think, to appeal to the most conservative Republicans who consistently vote in Republican primaries. You know, whether or not it's going to be successful, they have to get 315,000 valid signatures from registered voters in the state remains to be seen. But you're absolutely right, and Vicki has already pointed that out, that there are a lot of conservative Republicans who simply don't like the idea of hamstringing the legislature in terms of their oversight role over the executive branch of government. So this isn't just going to be a free pass for him politically.
Final topic for the lightning round today, Attorney General Bill Schuette, another yet-to-be-announced candidate for governor, issued an opinion which indicates it is not legal for Michigan school superintendent to withhold money from schools that persist in using Native American logos or mascots, which was under consideration. This affects a lot of schools. I mean, the Clinton Redskins, which, by the way, is Redskins also used by Belding, Camden, Marshall, Milford. There are also schools that use Braves, Warrior, a lot of schools that use the moniker Indians. Vicki, some surveys show that even the majority of Native Americans don't care about this, while a minority cares very much and find it offensive. A lot of conservatives say this is just another anti-free speech, political correctness thing that only snowflakes worry about. What's your view?
I don't think that, you know, throwing snowflakes on this issue is really what we need to talk about. But I don't like offensive names, period. But I do agree with Attorney General Schuette that you can't just withhold public education dollars from a school system just because the name of their mascot offends you. However, the American Indian community and the State Gaming Commission have come together to try to help school districts overcome the cost of changing mascots with a $500,000 annual fund coming from a lot of the gaming proceeds, putting together a fund that would support those changes. It's called the Native American Heritage Fund. And I think that we should pursue encouraging those school districts that have names that some of us may find offensive or the school board finds offensive to change their names and to help cover the cost. Schools aren't rolling in money right now. And to change the name of a mascot and all of the signage and everything else that entails is very expensive.
Ken, what do you think of Attorney General Schuette's opinion and this whole issue?
Well, I think he's right in the sense that regardless of how you feel about the issue, without proper legal authority, the state can't just unilaterally withhold funds from school districts. So I think he's absolutely on solid ground. But to the issue of some people are going to find the use of Native American logos offensive, I think the vast majority of people probably do not. And the Republican position is probably going to be that this is primarily a local decision to be made by local school boards and local voters.
That's Ken Sikkema. He's Senior Policy Fellow at Public Sector Consultants and a former Republican legislator. We also heard from Vicki Barnett. She's a former mayor of Farmington Hills and a former Democratic legislator. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Lester.
I want to introduce you to Hedy Steinbart. She is the mastermind behind Oma's cherry-infused vodka. Oma is German for grandmother. Are you the Oma of Oma's vodka?
Yes.
So how did you start making this vodka?
Well, you just started and make it.
Well, what led to you making it? Is this a family event or what?
It's a family. Usually when the family gets together, so they get a shot that gets served some Omar's Cherry Vodka.
Also joining us is Kyle Miller, the grandson of Hedy Steinbart. This cherry-infused vodka, this is legendary stuff in your family, I take it.
It is. It absolutely is. Oma's been a legend through my friends and family since she started making it and giving it to everybody. We use all natural cherries from Traverse City. We distill it here in Chicago. So we're trying to replicate the Midwest roots of the recipe and Oma's heritage.
So Oma Steinbart, you decided to give Kyle your recipe. You decided it was just too much of a fuss for you, and you gave it to him. Is that what happened?
I just gave it to him because I like to have him, and he wanted to have it.
Oma's been making it her whole life, and she's 92 today, and 2 years ago, I figured someone's got to step up and continue on the legacy. So she taught me the ropes, and then we've replicated it and now scaled it to where we're distributing in Michigan and throughout Chicago.
Yeah, I understand, Kyle. You started just making a batch of this cherry-infused vodka each year for friends and family. I guess it turned out to be pretty popular if you're taking it into production.
That's right. It was all about carrying on Oma's legacy. And once I sent it out for first batch around Christmas of 2015. And the feedback was very inspiring. People loved the story, they loved the product, and they loved Oma. So I wanted to turn it into something special. And we've had a lot of early success and looking to get out our family recipe and, more important, Oma's story to the general public.
And that's told on the label, I take it.
That's right. And we've got a sketching of her on the front. And then we've got a nice story about her and Oma and her heritage dating back to Germany.
Oma Steinbart, I understand that Oma's cherry-infused vodka is now beginning to be stocked on Michigan store shelves. So what did you think of that when you went in and saw a bottle of your vodka?
I said, good luck.
I was told that you were a little surprised at the price, a little bit of sticker shock.
Yes.
Was that a concern for you?
Not really.
Okay.
The state of Michigan sets a minimum price point. So it's a little more expensive than when we used to get it at Christmas for free. but well worth the price.
That is Kyle Miller, and we've been talking with Hedy Steinbart. They are the creators of a new spirit that's making an appearance on Michigan liquor store shelves now. It's called Oma's Cherry Infused Vodka. Thanks for sharing your family's vodka with rest of us.
Oh, you're very welcome. I hope it's going to sell a lot.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Here's a question that Flint is trying to answer. Should you lose your house to foreclosure because you didn't keep up with water bills during a period that the water wasn't safe to drink or to use for bathing? Here to try to unravel that issue for us is Genesee County Treasurer Deb Cherry. Michigan Radio recently found that more than 10% of Flint homes owe more than $1,000 in overdue water bills. The Receivership Transition Advisory Board is the state of Michigan board that was appointed in the wake of the city's emergency management. It says liens should be applied, even if it leads to state tax foreclosures. What's been your response to that situation?
Well, first of all, you should know that I have not accepted the liens from the city of Flint for delinquent water that they've put on the tax bills since the water emergency, which we see is in 2014.
So the city's been sending you this information saying, hey, this is a lien against this property, and you've not been putting that on the bill.
They sent it for the 2015 taxes. Remember, we're behind. First of all, they're behind in it being delinquent, and then we are collecting delinquencies, so we're like a year or two behind.
Right.
So what I did was, like in February, is when we start figuring out what we call the development of our settlement, which is where we determine how much money we're going to bond for. So in 2015, we did not accept delinquent water liens. We did accept the sewer, but not the water portion of the utility liens, which was about $800,000.
Total for the city?
Yes.
So why did you choose to do that? Why did you say, no, we're not going to put that portion of
Because it was an extra extraordinary kind of situation, because the water was poison. People couldn't drink the water. So my office and I did not decide that we weren't going to put those liens on because if they're not paid, the law says I have to foreclose on any property that is the tax bills aren't paid. And when the city gives us the lien, it becomes part of the tax bill.
Was this a moral issue for you?
For me, it was, yes. And it also, we believe by law that we didn't have to take it because it was an extraordinary event.
Do you have the authority to override the state-appointed board's authority, that receivership transition advisory board authority?
Well, this is 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
The receivership board hadn't taken any action. The city of Flint administration had, and they would probably argue that I don't, but we argue that if you look at the law, normally we would not, but this was an extraordinary event, and that it was a fraudulent tax because the water is poison.
What kind of repercussions could your office or you face for taking that position?
So far, nothing. I suppose that somebody could sue us, you know, to force me to collect. Then it would go to court, and we would have to see what the judge rules on. But we believe we have legal standing, not in normal circumstances, but this is a not normal, it's an extraordinary situation.
You've indicated that while this Flint water crisis continues, and for those of you who are not familiar with this, it does continue, until all those lead pipes are replaced and the water is consistently found to have lead levels below the allowable standards, that you won't move to foreclose. If that takes a couple of years or more to replace those lead lines or get the water to a consistently safe level, what happens? I mean, let's say it takes 2 years. What happens after that?
Well, the city can still try to collect. I mean, they still have the liens. The liens don't disappear just because I didn't take them. They are there. The city could try and collect. But what happens ultimately in regards to the collection of money is not something that I really would do. That's up to the city and the state, I guess.
Well, will you allow those liens after everything's cleared up?
Not for the period of time that this has been going on. After the emergency is lifted or the, you know, everything is cleared up, we would start collecting water liens again, but it would not be for the period of time that we're in this situation.
The concern expressed by the Receivership Transition Advisory Board, again, that's that state-appointed board, is that it's in Flint's best interest to get people to pay these water bills if the city ever hopes to get its water system costs under control. I mean, losing your house is a really big deal, but so is having a water system that could pay for itself. So how do you strike that balance in this situation?
That really is a problem in the city of Flint. They would have to decide what they would be doing. I personally, if it were me, I'd be looking at the state of Michigan to not only help, but to finance, publicly finance the system. It's because of actions that were taken with the city, with the state also, that created this situation.
Well, the state has in part. I mean, they were paying part of the water bills.
But my concern is with the citizens of the city, and that I do not believe that we should be foreclosing on property just because of the water liens. Now, we would foreclose on property if the taxes aren't paid, as we always do, but not for the water liens. And it's up to the city and the state as to how they get that money.
Now, as I understand, the lien remains in place. As you said, it's still there. You're just not going to enforce
accept
a foreclosure.
It. Yeah, I'm not going to accept the liens on the property. We will accept the property tax, the delinquent tax, but not the liens.
What do you recommend to homeowners who know that they have this lien on their property, and what should be their next move?
I think that they should be contacting the city of Flint.
Who's going to say you need to pay your water bill, or we're going to try to foreclose on you?
Well, they can't foreclose on them.
Well, not now.
Right.
I mean, I understand what you're trying to do. I understand what the city's trying to do. It's a mess. I don't know how we're ever going to get through this.
It is a mess, but that doesn't mean it is right to foreclose on people's homes because of it. I don't argue that it's a mess, but I think that the state should have a more responsible role in this, I guess. But that really is up to them on how they plan to deal with it. The only action really that I have and that I have authority is in terms of the collection or non-collection of the liens. And the only authority really I have that I believe I have is because it's an extraordinary situation and I don't have to accept those liens because of it.
That is Deb Cherry. She's the treasurer of Genesee County. Thanks very much for taking the time to explain this to us.
Thank you.
For 100 years, medical practitioners have been trying to figure out post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD. A recent article published by The Conversation suggests we need to expand thinking about PTSD and learn why different patients are helped by different approaches. Joining me are two of the authors of the piece, Marissa Brandt, who is an assistant professor of practice, and Robin Bloom, an associate professor of philosophy, both at Michigan State University. So let's go back 100 years. As soldiers came home from World War I, some of them had what came to be known as shell shock. How did doctors at the time diagnose that condition?
Doctors at that time diagnosed this condition largely through physical symptoms and behavior changes, ranging from a lot of melancholy to not being able to actually use your limbs to total catatonia. People had a wide range of symptoms that made it very difficult for them to go back to their lives and go back to work.
In the piece, you described that at first thought people had concussions or something like that, some kind of traumatic brain injury maybe, but then they found out eventually that that didn't necessarily have to be the case. So what did they decide shell shock was caused by?
There were a lot of different theories about what it was caused by, but during this time, the early 20th century, was also the rise of psychoanalysis and early psychology in America. And so it was a time when people started to think that maybe not only physical, you know, violence could create changes in people, but also psychological experiences, the meaning of experiences. And different psychiatrists working in different places had different theories, which led them to quite different treatments at that time.
Right. Some of them chalked it up to a personal failure, a weakness. And the treatments you mentioned were really bizarre. Could you tell me some of the brutal treatments that were described in a paper titled Hysterical Disorders of Warfare, which came out in 1918?
What happened is they would think that there was something sort of blocking the soldier from sort of returning to himself. And so I don't think they put it quite like this, but because the disorder was caused by some sort of shock or trauma, they almost seemed to think that having some sort of therapeutic shock or trauma might actually restore their function. So they would do things that now look absolutely horrifying to us, like using electric shocks or burning people with cigarettes to try to get them to overcome their problems.
Or react in any way in some cases.
In some cases, yeah.
Let's fast forward to the Vietnam War era. Medical thought has evolved through World War II and the Korean War. Vietnam veterans really started to take control of this issue themselves. They demanded treatment for PTSD. How did that affect how medical profession and others saw the disorder?
Well, just to step back a second, the Vietnam veteran activists of the 1970s, working with psychiatrists like Hai Shatan and Robert J. Lifton, were actually the people who got PTSD to be seen as a diagnosis in the first place. They had already been coming together, people like Vietnam Veterans Against the War, to create support groups where they saw their activism as part of their therapeutic treatment, but part of what they really wanted by getting the American Psychiatric Association and the military to recognize this diagnosis, which they successfully did in 1980, was to be able to get disability compensation, to be able to get access to treatment in the VA. But the VA at that time, you know, that was a new diagnosis. It was something that up till that point, you know, they'd been treating as depression, anxiety, psychosis in some cases, and treating based on those models. And so they really had to start improvising and working to come up with new treatments in 1980 because they were faced with a new diagnosis that suddenly explained the conditions of many of their patients.
Now, your article suggests that we cannot understand PTSD or its treatment if we keep thinking of it in strictly medical terms. Can you explain why you believe that?
I think strictly medical terms has to sort of come apart into two different concepts. There's the medical clinical sense, which is concerned with patients' experiences and how physicians and other healthcare professionals can help them. And then the biological sense, which is the idea that there's some sort of underlying people often use the term malfunction, something physiological that's not working well. And I think that the underlying physiology, even though it can be very important in helping us to understand what to do at a clinical level, in part because we don't have that knowledge now, is only of limited usefulness. But also, if we just focus on the biology, we're missing a lot of what the experiences mean to the people who are actually suffering from PTSD symptoms. And I think that without developing a sense of where they're coming from, there's really only a limited amount that can be done to help them.
I was surprised to read in the article that the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs estimates about 13.8% of returning veterans who served in Iraq or Afghanistan are dealing with PTSD. What kind of treatments are being offered today?
So in 2007, 2008, the VA and the DOD did a kind of massive overhaul where they researched all the kind of empirically supported treatments for PTSD. And what came out of that was recommendations for two psychotherapies, one called cognitive processing therapy, where a person writes about their trauma and the meaning of their trauma and tries to kind of work to different stages of processing that meaning. And then another one called prolonged exposure therapy, wherein a person actually tells the story of their trauma over and over again until they become desensitized or habituated to the feelings that are associated with telling that story. But not every VA is going to have the same number of therapists who are trained in those therapies, which are often very labor intensive. PE, for example, takes 90-minute sessions that you could have once a week or more, which are very difficult to schedule. So a lot of people end up getting pharmaceuticals. They end up on SSRIs or other drugs that help them to manage their symptoms like any other anxiety or disorder or depression.
You pointed out that the patient has a role in determining treatment, and that's helpful. Why is that?
One of the most important factors in somebody getting better is what's called the therapeutic alliance, the agreement between the therapist and the patient that they are in this together, that they have a common goal, which is helping this person to overcome their symptoms, overcome their problem for a particular reason. So if the patient doesn't believe in the therapy, right, or they don't want to do the therapy, there's only so much that a therapist can do to really convince them otherwise. So the patient's buy-in is really, really important to having a successful therapeutic relationship.
How well do we understand PTSD today?
I'm not sure. In one sense, I think we don't understand it any better than they did during the First World War. In another sense, I think we do know a lot more. So we have a better understanding, for example, of what kinds of treatments would be effective. We're definitely not burning people with cigarettes anymore. And we have a much better sense of what's going on in the brain when people process traumatic events or when they're haunted by traumatic events. But in terms of having a really good sort of conceptual understanding of what PTSD is, why some people get it and others don't, how to best help people who have different kinds of symptoms, because there's a lot of variability in the symptoms of PTSD, we're still really trying to understand the big picture.
I want to ask you about the conclusion of your article, because it kind of says, hey, we've got more areas to explore here. What's the bottom line that you want people to take away from the article?
I think that one of the things that we're doing well now that we weren't always doing in the past is to recognize how debilitating traumatic experiences can be and the long-lasting effects that they can have. So that's one thing that's, I think, really important, that we're paying attention and at least trying to do something. That said, I think that there's still a lot of work to be done.
I think it's important for us to not get overly limited in our thinking about how to help people. There's a lot of new apps that are supposed to help people with PTSD. And, you know, I've studied a lot of virtual reality therapy. And one of the things I hope people take away is that we should continue to expand those interventions in a variety of ways and also not be limited by thinking of any one treatment as being that which helps people, but really thinking about trauma as something that people deal with in a community, in a social setting, in our culture, and we all kind of have to come together and think about what it is we want to do for traumatized groups of people like veterans and what we want to do to support them and help them make meaning out of their experience. And while these interventions are great and diverse, I think it's on all of us to try to make a better world for people who experience these kinds of traumas.
That's Marissa Brandt, and we heard from Robin Bloom. They, along with Mary Catherine McDonald, are the authors of an article titled From Shell Shock to PTSD, A Century of Invisible War Trauma. You can find it at theconversation.com. Thanks to both of you for talking with us.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. We're joined on the phone now by Sonia Bonnet, who lives in Detroit. She's been hit with property tax bills adding up to $6,000. Sonia, thanks for talking with us. How is it that you ended up with that amount of property tax debt?
I acquired my home in 2012 through land contract through some pretty shady buyers. Long story short, the home was quick deeded to me because I got a letter in the mail stating that I owed $6,000 in taxes. I was buying the home through land contract. The taxes were included in my payments. These people never paid a dime in taxes. So after being quick deeded, the taxes were mine to pay. And because of that, I was not eligible for any payment plans or anything of that nature.
Were you eligible for a poverty tax waiver?
I have no idea because no one ever said poverty tax waiver or exemption to me at all.
Yeah, that's a problem we hear a lot, that people just aren't made aware of that option. I'm wondering, if you've got income tax records and you can get together with Wayne County and the City of Detroit, are they even interested in talking about retroactively adjusting for this?
No, I don't think they are. I can't say positively what they're interested in doing. I can say that upon this happening to me, I went through every avenue I possibly could. The big gatherings at the Cobalt Hall. I went through Wayne County Housing Coalition, who do great work with people. And I was not able to be helped. So I can't say what Wayne County would do personally. But no, I don't think that if I gathered everything and said, hey, you know, help me, they're going to say, oh, sure, now we will. No.
I'm wondering, with property values in most of Detroit down during most of the last decade, how did your tax bill end up being that high in the first place?
Illegal assessments.
And what do you mean by that? Why do you think they're illegal?
Well, I don't think they're illegal. I know they're illegal. Between the years of 2009 and 2015, the property in Wayne County were illegally assessed. And I don't have the numbers in front of me, not right now, so I won't quote, so I won't be misquoting. But that's why they're so high. And they shouldn't be, because the property value is definitely not anywhere near what a home would require $6,000 in taxes, if you've seen where I live, or in my neighbors, or, you know, on the other side of town, anywhere in the Detroit area, the urban Detroit area. It's ridiculous. And they were illegally assessed.
Sonia, are you going to lose your home?
No, I'm not. That's why I'm fighting.
How are you fighting it?
I'm fighting with a great group of people to end the unconstitutional tax foreclosure in Detroit. And we have a few demands for the city. And so either through, I don't know, keeping my home or receiving a home through the land bank, one way or the other, I'm going to stay in Detroit and I'm going to fight for that. So even if I move from this home to a home that's offered to me through the land bank, I'm not going to look at it as losing it.
Well, Sonia, the best of luck in that. That's Sonia Bonnet. She lives in Detroit, and she's trying to keep her home, even though she inherited $6,000 worth of tax debt. Thanks for talking with us.
Not a problem. You have a great day.
Now, you might hear about tax foreclosure crisis in Detroit and think, well, that's unfortunate, and then get on with your day. But the tax foreclosure crisis didn't just happen. It doesn't continue to happen by unfortunate circumstances. There are decisions behind it, and one group says those decisions are illegal.
According to the Michigan Constitution, no property should be assessed at more than 50% of its market value. It turns out, the city government systematically inflated the property tax assessments of homes in Detroit beyond this legal limit. In fact, between 2009 and 2015, 55 to 85% of Detroit properties were unconstitutionally assessed each year. This led to illegally inflated taxes on those properties.
That is from a short animated video released by the Coalition to End Unconstitutional Tax Foreclosures. Joining us now is Bernadette Atuwahene. She's a visiting professor of law at Wayne State University. You wrote a guest blog for the ACLU Michigan, and you say your research shows as many as 85% of homes in Detroit might have been taxed at rates that violate the Michigan Constitution. How did you arrive at that estimate?
Yeah, so the Michigan Constitution says that no property is to be assessed at more than 50% of its market value. Other state constitutions, to the extent that they mention assessments at all, say things like uniform, fair, equal, which means it's up to the judge to determine legality. Since Michigan's constitution and its supporting legislation and case law make it explicit that no property is to be assessed at more than 50% of its market value, that means people like me can come in and run the numbers. And that's exactly with what my co-author and I did. And we ran the numbers from 2009 to 2015, and we found that in each of those years, anywhere between 55 and 85% of properties were being assessed in violation of the Michigan State Constitution.
So how did that happen?
We have no, again, I can only say what I have evidence for. We have no evidence of kind of a master plan or malintent. What we do have tremendous evidence of is a bureaucracy, i.e. the assessment division, was in complete disarray, totally underfunded, totally understaffed. They're legally supposed to go out and look at 30% of the properties every year. They had not done that in at least two decades. And so what was going on is they were basically adjusting taxes from the year before, and that's how they were doing their assessments. But what happens in the Great Recession of 2008, when property, if you look at the property values for Detroit, they plummet.
The bucket fell out.
Absolutely. And there was never an adjustment at that point. And so their system of just kind of assuming a slow increase in property values just fell apart. And we had this extreme illegality going on in terms of unconstitutional property tax assessments.
So even if you're right, and the city is to blame for this tax foreclosure crisis because of ineptitude or not funding the division correctly or whatever the case may have been, I mean, what can be done about it? Those homes have been foreclosed upon. Many of them have been demolished at this point because of they quickly deteriorated or were scrapped. Is it too late? I mean, what's the point of talking about this now?
Right. So we have formed the Coalition to End Unconstitutional Tax Foreclosures, and there's several Detroit organizations that are part of the coalition, including, to name a few, CDAD, People's Platform, Michigan Legal Services, United Community Housing Coalition, We the People, et cetera. There's several organizations that have coalesced to do something, and we have three demands. Our first demand is to stop these unconstitutional property tax assessments. So you know that this past year, the city of Detroit actually finally, after over 50 years, did an actual assessment of the entire city. So for the first time, property taxes in Detroit are based on market values, which was what's supposed to have been happening all along.
I think a lot of homeowners would disagree that they're actual market values, because I've been told again and again and shown the paperwork, they say my house was worth $34,000. It had actually been worth about $14,000.
Well, we can disagree about what the market value is, but at least they are now generating property taxes based on a number that they think even before, the number was not even based on the market value. So again, market value is always a number that's contested. But the point I'm trying to get across is prior to that, they weren't even basing it on anything related to market value.
Right, so, no assessments at all.
Well, they were doing assessments, but not on market value.
Okay.
Our numbers show, so we reran our study after the this reassessment, and we found that even after the reassessment, homes worth $18,500 and under, over 90% of homes in this category are still being unconstitutionally assessed. So while a lot of the problem was fixed, the problem still has not been fixed for homes the lowest value homes. And that goes to the kind of larger result of the study, which was of that 55 to 85% of homes that was being unconstitutionally assessed, when we broke the data up into five quintiles from lowest value to highest valued homes, in quintile one and two, those with the lowest valued homes, we found that over 95% of those homes were being unconstitutionally assessed. And in quintile five, homes in the highest value category, those homes were actually being assessed under that 50% constitutional limit, which means that the burden of these unconstitutional assessments are really being borne by the homeowners with the lowest valued homes, who are ostensibly the poorest of the poor homeowners. So our first demand of the coalition is to stop these unconstitutional assessments for these poorest of the poor homeowners.
Okay, you said there are three. You had two more?
Second is, we are, just as you said, lots of people have already been subject to property tax foreclosure based on these unconstitutional assessments. So we're calling on the land bank. The land bank has from 32 to 33,000 vacant properties. And we're saying, let's make that available to people who were unconstitutionally assessed and foreclosed upon so that they can have a home. And we're also calling on MSHDA, the Michigan State Development Authority, to use the hardest hit funds that are now being used for demolitions. Let's repurpose that money from these corrupt demolitions. There's a federal investigation on the demolitions. Repurpose that money to helping people pay off some of these, again, these unconstitutional property taxes, and providing some kind of compensation to people who illegitimately lost their homes. So that's our second demand. And to that extent, we had a people's forum on June 17th. At Wayne State Law School, where we had seven breakout groups, over 100 Detroit residents who had been foreclosed upon in attendance, and they were there to create a restorative justice strategy and say what it is they want in compensation for being evicted based on unconstitutional assessments. And the third and final demand is to stop the impending foreclosure. So in the next month or so, the Wayne County Treasurer is going to foreclose upon lots of homes, and we're saying, let's stop. Don't foreclose on any owner-occupied homes. Take those out of the auction until we can confirm that none of these people, these delinquent tax owners, were being unconstitutionally assessed at any point. And so that's our third demand, is to put a halt on these owner-occupied homes going into foreclosure in the next month or so.
The county treasurer's office has consistently said, hey, look, our hands are tied. We have legislative required duties. We have to follow the law, and has avoided things like that. Here's the thing, though. We end up in past years, these home values over-assessed, over-taxed. People lost their homes. People are still losing their homes. Many of those houses were bought by investors, or I'll call them speculators. The houses were left vacant. Scrappers came in, destroyed the home. Property values of the neighbors were hurt. So theoretically, they're not paying the same taxes because of the decreased value. The city has been getting these federal tax dollars you're talking about to tear down abandoned homes by the tens of thousands. Still, at that rate, not keeping up with the number of new foreclosures. This is a vicious cycle. It doesn't seem to have an end. Why isn't somebody actually doing something about this?
So first of all, the Eric Sabree's claim that his hands are tied is incorrect. What is correct, so we've done a legal analysis, and what is correct is Eric Sabree does not have the power to erase any taxes owed. That has to come from legislation from Lansing. That is correct. But what he absolutely has the power to do is to put a moratorium on foreclosing on owner-occupied homes. That is absolutely within his power to do. And we are calling on Eric Sabree. The coalition is calling on Eric Sabree to do just that, to put a moratorium to not foreclose on any of the owner-occupied homes. As to why this is not happening, again, it's a lack of political will. But the two players who are most responsible or have the power to put a stop to this is Detroit's mayor and the Wayne County treasurer, Eric Sabree. So that's who we're calling upon. And we are actually having an action this Saturday, tomorrow, from 12 o'clock to 2 o'clock at St. Matthew's St. Joseph's Episcopal Church, located at 8850 Woodward Avenue. We're having a press conference and community meeting to call on the mayor and Eric Sabree to step up, take action, and bring justice to this completely unjust situation of unconstitutional property tax assessments and illegitimate tax foreclosure.
So who's going to be speaking at this gathering you're talking about?
Sonia Bonnet, who you just heard from, will be speaking, but we also have several other speakers. One is named Joseph Bates. Joseph's family, the house that got foreclosed upon, he and his family had lived in that house since 1907. His great-grandfather was Henry Ford's chauffeur. His grandmother was a lifelong Detroit public school teacher, deep roots in Detroit. He didn't graduate from high school, but he has worked in grocery stores his entire life. His income is under $12,000 a year. He clearly qualifies for the poverty tax exemption. Nobody told him about it. And
I don't understand why people aren't made aware of that. I just don't understand how that happens.
And that's actually one of the demands of the coalition, is to make this poverty tax exemption more accessible and to actually provide retroactive relief for people who were foreclosed upon, who weren't even supposed to be paying these taxes in the first place. Let's give them their houses back, do some retroactive relief based on this poverty tax exemption. So, yeah, Joe lost his house, again, that his family had been in since 1907 to property taxes that he wasn't supposed to be paying in the first place because he qualified for the poverty tax exemption.
I want to step back just a little bit to get some perspective on this whole foreclosure crisis. Your blog and that video we mentioned indicated between 2011 and 2015, one in four properties in Detroit was subject to property tax foreclosure. How does that compare to other cities? How does that compare historically? Have we seen something like this before or anywhere else?
Absolutely not. It is completely the only other time in American history we have seen this number of property tax foreclosures is in the Great Depression. And there's just no other city foreclosing on this quantity. Again, like you said, between 2011 and 2015, one in four properties in Detroit was subject to property tax foreclosure. That is astounding. And again, those numbers, last time we've seen that in American history is the Great Depression.
That's Bernadette Atuwahene, a researcher and visiting professor of law at Wayne State Law School. She's also a professor at the Illinois Institute of Technology's Chicago Kent College of Law. Thanks very much for coming in.
And if anyone wants more information, please go to illegalforeclosures.org. There you can see the video that was played on the show. You can hear more about our actions and get involved in this movement to stop these unconstitutional property tax assessments and these illegal foreclosures.
About that animated video we mentioned earlier in the interview, we've got a link to it on the stateside page at michiganradio.org. Also online with this interview, we're posting a 15-minute video interview with the ACLU's lead attorney. I did that with the Detroit Journalism Cooperative late last year. It outlines the lawsuit the ACLU and other groups filed against Wayne County and the city of Detroit regarding the tax foreclosure issues.
It's tragic. You know, the fact that the city is starting to come in line with state law helps people going forward, but it really doesn't help people who, and there's tens of thousands of them who have lost their homes over the past 5 years.
That's Michael Steinberg with the ACLU. He'll walk us through all the issues in that lawsuit. Support for the Detroit Journalism Cooperative on Michigan Radio comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the Ford Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. I have to make a correction. Earlier in the show, I said that Marshall High School mascot was the Redskins. A listener corrected us. The school changed its names to the Red Hawks some years ago. I was using an outdated list. I apologize for that. That's our show for today. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.